Hello, everyone, and welcome. Too many of us are going through life stressed, anxious, depressed, and alone. We carry scars from our past that follow us into the future. But what we've seen as weakness turns out to be our greatest strength. We are not the damaged, the defective, or the weak. We are the unbroken. Hello, once again, Unbroken Family. I'm your host, Pete Bucher. It's a delight and a privilege to be with you here. As always, today, this episode is really special. This is the third in our series of interviews of people who have just amazing stories to tell. And in this case, this man's name is Samuel Moore Sobel. He's written a book called Can You See My Scars? About a very sudden, unexpected trauma that left him with burns to his face and arms. And I'll let him tell the story as to how that happened. But most importantly is what it has meant to him, how it has shaped his life, his healing journey, and a really powerful message I think that is so important for us as Unbrokens, which is how he came to a place of forgiveness in his heart for someone who never asked for it, for someone who never really even acknowledged what happened to him. And I think it's a really remarkable tale. His book is a riveting page-turner of a read, and so I highly recommend checking out his book, Can You See My Scars?, so you can read his first account for himself. But without further ado, let's dive into the interview, and then we'll talk about how you can get a hold of Samuel, share your thoughts, share your stories, and get to know him. He's just a delightful individual, an amazing person, and someone I know that you're going to really connect with as soon as you hear him tell his story and speak about it. So without further ado, here's my interview with Samuel Moore Sobel. Okay, so I am here with Samuel Moore Sobel, who has written a book, a fantastic book, by the way, called Can You See My Scars? And I'll let Samuel set up what that means to him and what the story is about. Samuel, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Peter, for having me. It's an honor to be here with you today.
Yeah, that's great. And why don't you just, for the sake of our audience, just introduce yourself, tell them a little bit about yourself, where you are, what you do, what you're up to, and most importantly, why you wrote this book.
Sure. Yeah. So again, my name is Samuel Moore Sobel. I am a resident of Northern Virginia, so I live just outside of Washington, D.C. I have pretty much born and raised here, grown up here. And am a program manager by day in the tech industry, but I have written this book and get the chance to do some motivational speaking and other writing on in my free time. So yeah. I wrote this book, Can You See My Scars? Because I wanted to be able to, number one, tell my story in my own voice and make sense of what happened to me and the trauma that I endured. But most importantly, I wrote this book because I wanted to inspire and encourage others who may be going through adversity and trials of their own. What I learned through this experience is that adversity is the great equalizer. And so all of us have opportunities to go through adversity and we respond differently. And what I learned was, you know, responding in how we respond is a choice. And so I wanted to encourage others along their journey. So hopefully they could see the things I did wrong and the things I did right and be encouraged by it and that they could incorporate it in their own journeys.
Yeah, and that's so powerful. I think just the willingness to share the story and all of these things that you just mentioned, you do so well in your book. And I think it's I love it because it's just very authentic. It's very honest. These are the areas like the areas where you really struggled. You're very honest about that. And the areas where you kind of start to come through it, and you start kind of start to see things a little bit differently. You spell that out in really beautiful ways. So very, very powerful witness to what you went through. But as most of us who are survivors of trauma of various types, again, just reading a story that we can connect with, and even if it's a different kind of trauma, we connect with the feelings, we connect with what you went through, the healing journey, a lot of the themes that we'll get into as we get into our interview here. So it's just so well written, though, and it just really pulls you one chapter to the next. And the reason is, yes, it's very well written. But two is, it's just that the story is so compelling and you do a great job of kind of setting up each thing as it comes. So it's kind of like we just keep wanting to follow your journey. So we connect with you, you know, as the central force of the story, of course, in your journey. And then that, for me, that really pulled me through it, because I kind of felt like I was right there with you the way that you wrote it. It's fantastic. So why don't you just for the listeners, now you go through in great detail, of course, your journey with what you went through, which is so powerful in the book. But for my listeners, why don't you set it up? Why don't you tell us a little bit about what happened to you? And then we'll kind of get into some of these other pieces.
Well, first off, thank you for that praise. I really appreciate it. I'm so glad you enjoyed the book. So my story begins a week before I'm set to start my sophomore year of high school. I'm eager to complete one last odd job before the end of the summer, to have a few extra books of extra cash on hand before I start the school year. And I'm hired for a day.
I don't want to interrupt you, but tell so when was this? Can you set it up for the audience? When? How long ago has this been now?
Oh yeah, it was September 1st, 2009. So 11 years ago.
Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
It's been a bit. No worries. Yeah, that's a good catch. Yeah. So it's been a little bit since then, more than 11 years now. But yeah, I was getting ready to, you know, finish out the summer, get this one last odd job, and I'm hired for a day by somebody who lives in my same community, you know, nearby from my parents' house. And he describes the job. I go to meet with him beforehand, and he kind of describes the job as moving furniture and boxes and various items that are in his garage. And he just wants to move these. And I understand it as we're moving these to a storage facility that's nearby. But when I arrive on that day on September 1st, 2009, everything starts to change from the get-go. And again, I'm kind of chalking it up to, oh, maybe I misunderstood. Maybe I got the details wrong. And kind of throughout the day, though, it's this common theme of a lot of just chaotic changes and movements and just really hard to keep up with at times. But upon arrival at the job, I'm told, oh no, we're taking, instead of taking things to the storage unit, we're going to go empty the storage unit and bring it back to the house. And so I have a friend with me. We're both there, a fellow friend from high school, and we, you know, start the day. So we, you know, end up at the storage facility. We're emptying the storage facility. We bring all that stuff back to his house. And I remember, you know, getting back to the house, and we're taking items from the truck that he wants to store at his house. And then again, it's revealed, oh, there's going to be another change here. We're taking whatever he doesn't want to store at his house to a friend's house. And I'll never forget, you know, that at this point, you know, it's supposed to be 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. We're now past 2. And I'll never forget my dad calling me. And here I am. I'm a 15-year-old, you know, boy. I'm 6 weeks away from my 16th birthday. And my dad calls me and he says, oh, you know, I think it's time for you to go home. And, you know, I'm feeling a little nervous at that point. And, you know, having this conversation with my dad, the man overhears, and I'm relaying this to the man. And he says, oh no, you know, the house, it's just, my friend's house is just 10 minutes down the road, right? It's nearby. It's no big deal. And so I'm having this conversation, and my dad, that seems to sort of assuage my dad. And, you know, I end up saying, okay, we're going to go on this job. Of course, you know, 5 minutes turns into 10 minutes and 10 minutes turns into 15 minutes and 15 to 25 and 25 to 35. And by, you know, by this time we've crossed, you know, county lines and we're literally in the middle of nowhere. And I'll never forget, you know, we're driving along and the man's driving this U-Haul and, you know, he has to literally take a U-turn off the main highway to even get to his destination. You know, we go up this gravel road, there's a house at the top of this gravel road. And, you know, we end up, so he's going to have to back the truck down. And he's telling us that it's, you know, we're going to be emptying things into this woman's shed. And so we meet this woman, she comes out and she's got, you know, some dogs around her and they're barking and, you know, a lot of commotion. Eventually, you know, the truck gets backed all the way down to the end of the hill. And, you know, the man comes out and he says, okay, well, we have till nightfall. And I remember thinking, oh, this is not what I signed up for. You know, now we're in the middle of nowhere. It's, you know, it's like, I remember going to grab my phone. It's almost 4 o'clock. I'm really concerned about the time. But before I can do that to call my parents or you know, do anything, this woman opens the shed and she looks in and it's just, again, filled to the brim with items. It's, you know, boxes and furniture and glass and just exercise equipment. Everything's in there. And so she says, instructs us, we're going to have to take everything out of the shed before we can get the stuff on the truck into the shed. So again, just this mismanagement of project. So we finally get to this point where we, you know, take the, we're starting to take stuff out and the very first box ends up in my hands. And the woman says to me, toss it, just toss it. So I remember looking down in this box And it, you know, I'm trying to get a sense of what's in there. It's open. It's just this cardboard, normal moving box, standard size. And I look down and there's books and there's hay. And when I say hay, it's literally straw protruding from this box. And I think, well, this is really an odd assortment of items, but who am I to judge what people have in their sheds? I'm kind of holding back laughter because I think it's kind of funny. I've never seen a box like this. And so, you know, I toss it as instructed. There's a cement slab just a few feet away. And again, just for your listeners, I'm over 6 feet and the slab's just a few feet away. And that'll become important in a second here. But as I, you know, toss this box, the second it hits that slab, I hear this explosion. This explosion rings out and I close my eyes instinctively, really by God's grace, close my eyes and this substance comes flying towards me. I don't know what it is at this point. And it hits my face. And the second it hits my face, the pain begins. Like I feel this, you know, and the only way I can describe it is that it's as if someone took a match or a lighter and just lit me on fire. And I'm just, you know, it's just burning holes into my skin. And I remember crying out. I feel like I'm unable to stand. So eventually, you know, I'm led up to the top of this hill, you know, the man's on the phone with 911. My friend convinces him to call 911. He's on the phone with 911, and he's having this conversation and they ask him, okay, so what was in the box essentially? And he doesn't know. So he hands me the phone, leaves me at the top of the hill and runs back down. And I'm standing at the, you know, top of this hill with the phone to my ear and the 911 operator trying to walk me through, you know, what to do, keeping me calm, really emphasizing the need for water. That doesn't really end up happening. You know, no water is provided. So eventually, you know, the ambulance arrives and they take the stretcher out of the ambulance and I'm lifted onto the stretcher. And I remember just looking around and there's all these trees that are surrounding the property, really large trees. And I remember silently wondering to myself if this was the last time I was going to see trees. I remember really feeling like this was going to be the end and really praying and really wrestling with, hey, I didn't want to die. I had a lot of life left to live. I was 15. I didn't want this to be the end. And so I remember just really wrestling with that of wondering if this was going to be the end of my life. But you know, the second they put me in the ambulance, they're really worried about my eyes, so they're flushing my eyes. At some point in this ambulance ride, it's articulated to me that the woman had told, I guess, the authorities that this substance was sort of the bottom of this box by her ex-husband. Her ex-husband was a sculptor, and so that's why it was there. Baffling that it was stored in that way, but that's what happened. And you know, get to the hospital, the doors of the ambulance open. The stretcher's pulled out of the ambulance. I get thrown into this chemical shower. I'm stripped naked. And that's the only moment in this whole time of this story where the pain starts to subside a bit. The water and the chemical in the chemical shower really starts to bring a little bit of peace. And I'm starting to able to kind of come out of the shock of what had happened. From there, you know, they wheel me back into a room. It's very clear from the beginning. They're telling me, hey, you know, we're going to transfer you to Children's Hospital. The hospital was not equipped to deal with a burn injury such as I sustained. And I should mention as well, so it turns out this was sulfuric acid, very dangerous chemical that was stored in this box. I suffered second and third degree burns on my face and on my arms. And at this point, so I'm wheeled back into this room. And the man arrives, he's talking to me, and it comes out that I haven't seen myself yet. And a nurse hears this and says, oh, do you want to have a look? And before I can answer, throws a mirror in my face. And so or my lap, and I pick up this mirror and I'm looking. And that's the first time I see myself after what's happened. And it's just these large brown and black stains. I don't recognize myself. I don't recognize the image reflected back to me. And I'm terrified. It's startling.
Yeah.
It was so from there, my mom arrives just in time to tell me she loves me. And I get thrown onto the helicopter. The helicopter takes me to Children's Hospital. And then the first thing I remember after getting in the hospital, I dozed off and then I wake up and there's this family friend who's got tears in his eyes upon seeing me. He gets pulled out of the room by his wife. And then my dad, and then composes himself, comes in. My dad does the same thing where he's got tears in his eyes, gets pulled out. And so at this point, I'm really worried. You know, what am I looking like? Am I looking even worse than what the image I saw in the mirror just a few hours before? And so I'm asking this family friend, what do I look like? How do I look? How do I look? Over and over again. And she keeps telling me, I'm looking at the inside, not the outside.
Yeah. Probably not what you want to hear at that time.
Yeah. You're like, oh, wow, it must be bad.
You know? Yeah.
So that's what I was thinking.
Yeah. Wow. It's such an ordeal. And I guess just to kind of give the Cliff's Notes version. So after that, then multiple procedures, surgery, steroid injections in your face, laser treatments. How many procedures in all at this point have you had?
So at this point, it's more than a dozen surgeries that I've had between the laser and reconstructive and everything else. And my last surgery was only 2 or 3 years ago. So it was pretty recent. So it was a long journey of just being in and out of the operating room and trying to, you know, get the face that I have now, which looks great, admittedly. I mean, it looks like none of this ever happened almost. You know, I've got some scarring still, but I can get away most of the time without people seeing, you know, or noticing that I was in an accident with sulfuric acid. I think most of my last doctor told me it looked like I was just in a bad bike accident. Yeah. So I was very, quote, lucky in the outcome, in his words.
Yeah, definitely you were. And I think it's notable in the book that for a period of time, it seems like a lot of people that you introduce, especially as you start going back to school and you see your teachers and your counselor and different people along the way, it's kind of brought up to you that, oh, you know, it could be worse. Oh, I was expecting it to be worse. I was expecting more damage. Talk to me about how that feels when you hear that from people, when you're first trying. I mean, you're very honest about how difficult it was to try to reintegrate yourself back into, you know, school and back into society, so to speak. So what's it feel like when people are saying, oh, I thought it would be a lot worse, or I was expecting more damage?
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, you know, one of the things that as I was reintegrating was I was feeling so self-conscious about how I looked. And again, I, even as it was looking better for me, I saw the image of what I looked like the first time I saw myself sitting in the hospital, which obviously was way worse back then than it was even in the weeks afterwards. So I still kind of have that image. And people were saying, oh, well, you know, it could have been worse. What I felt in that moment was it felt like, one, downplaying what had happened to me, but two, it also felt like almost an eradication of what had happened to me. It was kind of like, well, this wasn't really a big deal, right? And one of the things I was learning along this journey is it wasn't just how I looked. You know, it was also how I felt. It was also the mental health struggles that I was experiencing, right? So, you know, I talked about in openly in the book about, you know, struggling with just the visible scars, right? It was the invisible scars that were on the inside that people couldn't necessarily see, that in some ways were even more impactful to me than the ones that people could see or said they couldn't see, right? So, you know, it was really hard, and it just felt like an invalidation of what I'd gone through. And one of the things I really had to go through in this journey is claiming my journey for myself and not allowing other people to kind of, you know, drown out my voice with their own thoughts. And what I've learned, to be fair to other people, I think it wasn't that people necessarily were trying to be mean. I mean, I'm sure there were some who were, but I think people were so horrified by the experience that to them, especially in the religious context, they couldn't imagine how this could have happened or God could have allowed this to happen. And so they tried to, you know, prescribe something to make them feel better. It really wasn't about me. And I had to learn that. I think a lot of times those of us who go through trauma, who are survivors of trauma, encounter people who offer reactions that literally have nothing to do with us, but it's hard because we're in the moment and it's being directed at us. So I really had to learn the difference between the two. And that took a long time. And I took it very personally, especially in those first few years, and was really upset about the reaction that others offered.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why I asked the question, because I think so many of us have our stories invalidated by other people and even well-meaning people. I mean, I got the sense that some of these people were just like, they were trying almost like they were trying to say it as a way to comfort you. And I think you hit the nail on the head. Often they're trying to comfort you to deal with their own feelings of inadequacy. Like, I don't know what to say. I don't know what to feel. This is horrifying to me, but I don't want him to feel that. So it's like they're comforting themselves by trying to comfort you. And then it just kind of has the opposite effect. And I think that's such a such an important point for my listeners to hear, is that's kind of, unfortunately, a normal part of the experience when you start talking about, well, for you, very, you know, it's much more on the surface. What people can see, the damage that was done, of course, for a lot of us, it's, we start to get to come out and talk about things that, that other people don't, wouldn't know about otherwise. But when you start to come out and tell your story and talk, and in your case, coming back into society to have the courage to do that, and then to have somebody meet you with, oh, it's not that bad. It can be really dampening to your spirit for certain.
Absolutely. That's a great observation. Totally agree with that.
Yeah, that's good. So I want to get into a couple of other themes here, because I think you're very honest about sort of the mental health struggle and the emotional struggle that you go through. Of course, you're going through multiple procedures. You said that the accident happened 11 years ago on September 1st. You've been through more than a dozen procedures as recently as a couple of years ago. So you're in and out of hospitals. You're tell the story of how you weave in and out of all these different doctor's offices. Some of them very non-compassionate, non-empathetic. Some of them were very kind and you resonated with and felt more comfortable with at different times, which I think we can all sympathize with. But you're also very honest with sort of the mental and emotional struggle that you go through, and kind of that journey, that underlying journey of, like you said, healing the inner scars while you're getting all this outer work done on your face and your arm and the burn injuries and the scar revisions and all the stuff. This inner wounding that you're dealing with is such a compelling part of the story. And I think you do a nice job of suggesting it at times where things are a little more on the surface, and then really diving deep when you need to in the book. So talk to us a little bit about that journey and kind of what you learned along the path, or what was kind of the turning point. So somewhere in there, how would you describe that for the listeners?
Yeah, wow, that's a really good question. I think one of the things as I was going through this experience, there was so many feelings at once. It was hard to narrow it down and say, oh, this was the overarching feeling, right? There was so many feelings of those sense of, who am I and what is my identity now that I've lost my face, right? It was really that. And then you've got the grief and loss component, and you're really working through, okay, I'm losing so much of my experience as a young adult, right? I felt robbed, right, of that. But then also the health implications of this. And so there was so many feelings. And going in and out of surgery, it reopened kind of Pandora's box, as it were, right? I would go through that and it would be the same areas that they were working on. And so it would just feel like, oh, I've got to relive all this all over again. And that was really hard. And I think, one of the things, I had a great psychiatrist who I talk about in the book, Dr. Leo, who was somebody who was so skilled at really allowing me and empowering me to be the hero in my own story, right? He does that. And I talk about those passages of, he's really forcing me to come to grips with what happened. And he's not, giving me easy answers, right? And there's times I get kind of frustrated with him. I want him to just tell me, what it is. And he doesn't. And so there's some humorous passages in there of kind of like, where I said at one point, well, what do I pay you for? Right. And
right.
He kind of chuckles and, will reveal things, and which was really, is kind of funny in retrospect. But, he was so patient with me, and he talked a lot about developing the tools. And you have a toolbox and you have this arsenal of tools. And so for me, it was, counseling was a tool, medication. I was on medication for a brief time to kind of help, work out with some of the symptoms I was experiencing, especially with the PTSD and depression and being insomnia and not being able to sleep. So there was a whole, tools in that, that he was really encouraging me, and writing was a tool in that too, and writing what had happened to me. So I think the turning point was, as I was going through this struggle of feeling all these feelings and really grieving the loss of my face and, grieving what this had done to me and how this had totally redirected my life, I really had to wrestle with who I was going to be. And there was moments where I was really focused on self-pity. And I talk about that in the book. It was poor me, and I felt this anger. Maybe it was righteous anger, right, for what had happened. But I realized that there was a kind of this turning point for me as I go through. And it wasn't necessarily in a day. It was a journey, right? I always emphasize with audiences now, I think this is where I am 11 years afterwards, right? So in this, it took a long time to get to that place. Sure. So I want to, there's no quick fix here, right? Silver bullet. But, for me, I think it was really realizing that I had a choice to make, that even in the trauma that had happened, you know, I couldn't control what had happened to me. I couldn't control people's responses to me. I couldn't control how so much of what happened to me in my daily life. But what I could control was the attitude I was going to espouse. And was I going to be somebody who was overcome with bitterness over what had happened? Or was I going to be somebody who wanted to not only get through this adversity and conquer this experience, but also turn around and impact others. And that's really what I wanted to do. You know, I talk about, you know, with audiences a lot. I don't include it in the book, but one of the reasons why I wrote the book was I remember just a few weeks after the accident, lying awake one night and, you know, not being able to sleep. And it was midnight, 1 a.m. and just really reliving the accident and going through this. And I remember sitting up and just having the thought, it was like a light bulb went off in my head and saying, I'm going to write about this one day. Yeah. And the goal was to really use this experience to impact others. Because again, if I wasn't out there talking about it, if I wasn't out there writing about it, then it would just be this horrible accident that never should have happened. So for me, I always had this attitude of saying, you know, I want to have some sort of redemptive access to this story. And so for me, that's inspiring and encouraging others. And so that was really the turning point for me, was realizing, hey, I can use this story to impact others for good and make the world a better place, and maybe ensure that what happened to me doesn't happen to other people. And so that was really the motivating factor.
Yeah, that's fantastic. You have a passage in here I want to share, because I think a lot of people will resonate with this. And it's kind of at this point where you've been through the accident and you're going through the early parts of the treatment, and it's obvious that you're really down. Of course, you're 15 years old, right? So at 15, of course, your worldview is a little different anyway. And then to go through something so horrific and so life altering at such a young age, that you clearly become very depressed. And you say in this quote, I thought was just something that so many people will resonate with. You said, I scraped by and it was a miracle, but it felt like a half shell of the life I had once lived. Right. And in that time you said, and in your mind, it occurred to you that the only way out might be death. And it was kind of like you hit that bottom, and then it felt like at that point you realized no. And what I took from that was, you talked about your family. And you talked about the love, you know, I sort of took from that, the love that you have in your life, the love you have for them, the support that you felt like you had. And then that's when you decided, okay, I'm going to go get help. And that's when you started seeking out, I believe that's when you sought out Dr. Leo, I think was the psychiatrist, and you went to see a therapist for a while with EMDR and some of these techniques. But just such a powerful story. And also because you mentioned Dr. Leo and how supportive he was of you. I loved it when you went on the medication, you had this whole thing with your father about going on medication, and then you ultimately get back into going on the medication. And then you decide after a few months, okay, it's time to come back off. I don't like the side effects. I feel like I'm in a better place. And you go to Dr. Leo and you kind of get up the courage to tell him, I don't want to go on this medicine. He goes, it's up to you. It always has been. I love that. What an empowering message. I wish... As a medical professional, now retired from that world, but I wish all of my colleagues were so empowering of their patients. That's beautiful. Now, I don't want to give too much away from the story, because I really do want people to read this book. I think anybody who's been through trauma, anybody who just needs a great read, but something you can really connect to. I mean, I really do want my listeners to read this, because it's just so powerful. But there is a component to the story that I don't want to give too much away, but is a really important part, I think, of your healing journey, as we kind of talked about offline, which is that technically in this situation, as you came to find out in a sort of a moment, I'm sure, of great letdown, there was no real crime committed, at least by the statutes that were on the book. And so there was really no legal justice to be served. And in fact, at some point you sort of cross paths with one of the people involved, actually a couple of the people involved in various ways, with really no acknowledgement whatsoever that this had happened to you. Yet somehow in your heart, you kind of had to come to some level of peace in yourself. And I think for my audience, for the different types of trauma that we've been through, it's such a common story that someone traumatizes you, something bad happens to you, you have a story, you go through this whole big, we go through this whole big healing journey, and there's really no justice served on the other side, no acknowledgement, there's no apology, there's no, in fact, many times we're told that we're crazy, that, you know, we did something wrong. At some point, someone, even in your church, suggest that it's because of the sins of your parents that this happened to you. It's, you know, it's not only your fault, but it's your parents' fault. It's just such a common thread, unfortunately, people who go through trauma. So talk to me a little bit about how you came to a place of peace and even forgiveness for the people involved in this situation.
Yeah, that's so accurate. I feel like there's so many people who undergo trauma and have that common thread. You're so right. And I, you know, for me, I think it looks different for everybody, right? I think forgiveness is sometimes in our culture, I think it's this described as this one size fit all. And I think there are varying levels of forgiveness, and it's a process, right? I think forgiveness, it took me many years to get there. This was not an overnight decision that I made or an overnight place that I reached along the journey. But I think, you know, two things. So one, I think, you know, I'd made this deal with myself and others. I was very angry at what had happened. I felt like there was such a lack of justice. And I felt that. And I used to talk a lot about that, especially during those early years of feeling like there just wasn't justice and being very angry about that. And I had to come to this place where I had to realize that I couldn't reach that place no matter how circumstances changed, right? So I made this deal with myself, right? That if my life worked out, if I was able to go to college and get a good job and, you know, find someone to love and get married and buy a house and live that kind of, you know, that life that so many of us want, then I would feel better, right? Then I'd be able to reach that place of forgiveness because life would have worked out. But what I realized was that it doesn't matter, you know, that saying, right, wherever you go, there you are. It was true. I mean, it doesn't matter what my circumstances were. I still felt that. You know, there was a period of time where I went to college and I didn't want to talk about this story anymore. I didn't want to, you know, be known as the boy who was burned, and I didn't want to think about it anymore. But then I realized it was still me. I mean, I still had those feelings. I still had those feelings of anger. People still ask me about, you know, the scars on my face. I mean, it was something that was just there and I couldn't ignore it. And so I decided that since I couldn't ignore it, I could spend the rest of my life bemoaning what had happened to me, being angry about what had happened to me, being angry at the people that caused this, or even angry at myself, right? Or I could turn around and say, you know what, I'm going to embrace the scars that I do have. And I don't have all the answers as to why this happened, but I can also look back on the things that happened and see the lessons that I learned through it. Right. Yeah. So I want to, I'm never going to look back and be happy this happened, but I can see the ways in which, you know, the lessons that I learned along the way were invaluable. And I'm not sure that I would have been able to learn those lessons any other way. Yes. And so for me, getting that place of forgiveness was really about reframing what had happened to me and reframing perspective, right? I've heard it said it's all about perspective. It really was for me. I had to change the words that I used to describe the accident. I had to change my thinking patterns to get to place to say, you know, I'm not happy this happened, but it did happen. And in some ways I've been able to, it's made me a better person, right? It's refined who I am. It's refined my character. And I've, you know, leaned into those lessons. And so I'm proud of the scars that I have. And they're symbols of survival to me, right? They're no longer objects that I want to do away with. I talk about, you know, in the book, I used to really want to do away with these scars. And now I wear them as symbols of survival. I used to look in the mirror and say, oh, you know, they used to remind me of the worst day of my life. And now they remind me of what I was able to go through and how I was able to survive and make a comeback. And that gives me hope so that whatever I face in the future, I have that life experience now that I can fall back on and say, hey, if I was able to get through it then, I'll be able to get through it again, whatever comes my way. So I think forgiveness was coming to that place of saying, it was what I learned, it was never really about the other people. It was about me. It was about coming to a place of understanding what had happened to me, of reframing, and then making the choice to say, you know, I forgive the people who did this to me, whether they saw it or not, right? Because I realized that the anger and the bitterness I felt was only hurting me. It wasn't hurting them. I think sometimes we hold on to that resentment because we think, hey, you know, we want to punish those who've done this to us. But you know, they didn't care. They didn't recognize who I was. Is the story was referenced, right? I walked right by the man. I was on election day, you know, he was handing out flyers and he didn't recognize who I was. So to me, I wasn't punishing anybody but myself. And in order to live the best life I could in the present, I had to let it go. And so I had to make that choice. I think forgiveness is a choice, but it's also, you know, using that whole toolbox of going back to the counseling and the medication communication and the writing and all those things of really coming to that place that got me there. And again, I can't emphasize enough, it takes a long time. And it was probably, you know, really writing this book and getting this to a place where probably in the last year or two, where I really felt that sense of complete forgiveness and where I can honestly say, I forgive the people who did this to me, whether justice was done or not, you know, I can forgive.
Yeah, no. And that's such an important piece of the story. And what you said in there, you said so many golden things in that answer, but this piece about holding on to the anger and resentment was only hurting you. And that's such a harsh reality that we want justice. We want, you know, sometimes revenge, and we want, you know, at least some acknowledgement or anything, right? Just to, because it's such a heavy burden to carry. But then we start to realize over time that, yeah, this is only damaging me, and how can I, you know, again, open my heart and just love myself through this and let them figure out, you know, whatever it is they need to figure out in life. I think that is such a wise perspective and so helpful. And also, the scars that you wear, you said, you know, they remind you of what you're able to go through. And we talk about on the show, like how, you know, these things that we see that make us weak or different or defective or damaged, how they actually are the signs of our greatest strength. These are situations we survived. We showed up in our biggest self to get through something horrible. And then, you know, hopefully we can find the benefit on the other side. Unfortunately, some people never do, but hopefully that we do. And that's such an important part of that healing process. So I love that. So thank you for sharing those insights, very much in line with everything we talk about in this show. It's just fantastic. So what is it that you're doing today that you find most helpful to kind of keep you now on this healing path, kind of keep you going forward in a way that feels good to you?
Yeah, you know, that's such a great point, because, you know, healing is it's a journey, but in some ways it's a daily journey, even long after, you know, trauma has occurred, even if you've come to that place of forgiveness, even if you've made it through the other side, even if life is really, you know, great now, you know, my story ends up having a happy ending, right? You know, I got everything I wanted, right? But you know, at the same time, I even found a beautiful woman to love and marry. We just got married 2 months ago.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been such a happy time. But even in that, right, there's days where I see the trauma or the things that I've experienced or some of those patterns come up even in the context of my relationship with my wife, right? And I have to, you know, work through that and identify that and say, wait a second, no, that's not who I am. You know, and so I have to work through that. And I realize now that, especially in the context of marriage, the way I'm feeling, and if I'm having a bad day, that's going to affect my wife, right? It's not just me anymore. And so that kind of brings me to a place of having to, okay, well, I got to re-examine. And so in some ways, you know, I've had to come back to the well, as it were, come back to that toolbox. And for me, you know, the big things I have to consistently do, are journaling, you know, writing. So I try to take time, and I wish I had the time to do it every day and was as disciplined as I should be. I should do it every day, but I try to do it as often as I can, even if it's just a paragraph or two in a journal of just saying, hey, this is how I'm feeling. That makes a huge difference. You know, secondly, you know, diet and exercise are so important. You know, I've got to get out there. I've got to run. You know, I try to exercise, you know, 5 days a week now, and that really helps, you know, to keep my mind, you know, just really help process those emotions. I find when I'm running, especially, I can work through some of those emotions and can come back feeling just relieved, right? So those are some of the few practical things that I do. And obviously faith's an important part as well. My faith's important to me. And so, you know, reading the Bible, getting into the Word is really important part of that as well. But, you know, just really taking the opportunity, I think the biggest thing too is getting outside myself and reading the stories of others, right? So yes. I'm a big believer in that, of saying, you know, that, and I know as what happened to me, as horrible as it was, there's so way more heinous stories out there, right? There's stories that are even worse if you want to compare it, right? Not that I do that, but if you compare it to other people, there's so many things that happen that are so horrible in the world. And I think getting outside of my own experience and reading those stories is so impactful. Yes. You know, I spent a lot of time, I'm a big supporter of the Phoenix Society for Burn Survivors. In fact, a percentage of the profits from this book go to support the Phoenix Society. Love that organization. And they sent out a quarterly newsletter, and, you know, reading those stories of other people just really warms my heart. You know, and I talk about it in the book, of being able to go to a World Burn Congress. It was really the first time I spent so much time around other burn survivors, and it really getting a sense of even connection from afar, especially in this time of COVID-19 and the ongoing pandemic, of connecting with other stories virtually really means the world to me. And again, it makes me remember that I'm not the only one who's ever undergone trauma, and there's other people who have insights out there, and I can adopt that into my own story. But just knowing someone else is out there who has gone through that means the world to me. So those are just a few things that I do, but it is really important to continue to keep your mind fresh and to keep processing those emotions. It's a lifelong journey.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. These emotions do resurface, and they are triggered at times, maybe when you least expect them, and just the awareness of them, and that's what's happening, and then being able to give them a safe place to be is just such an important piece of the healing process. And you know, the reality is, yeah, the healing is never 100% done for a lot of these things. So we just, you know, but I'm sure that sitting here today, you feel like a very different person than you did 11 years ago at this time. So, you know, so it is the gift, the tincture of time, as we sometimes say, but not just time, really being intentional about your healing process, which you described very well. So I love that. If you could go back today, in a time machine to yourself 11 years ago, just a month and a half or so after having gone through this, what would you tell that young man? Put you on the spot here.
Wow. Yeah, that's a great question. I think, you know, so many things, right? Yeah. I think the big thing, you know, one of the things I just remember, I think the big thing, like, you know, a month after the accident, I remember the night of the accident lying awake, and I talk about it in the book, but you know, one of the first things I really struggled with was, you know, is a woman ever going to love me, right? Is anyone ever going to love me after how I look? And I was so wrapped up in that journey. And I think the biggest thing, if I could go back and tell myself, is you're going to find someone, right? She's out there, and you're just going to have to be patient. You're going to have to wait. And you can use these years now. And Dr. Leo tried to tell me this too, but you could use these years now to prepare to find her, right? And prepare so that you're in a healthy place so that when you do find her, you can have a healthy relationship with her. But I think that's the biggest, I think that if I could identify the biggest mistake I made was, you know, it led me into a lot of different relationships that some were abusive, right? Emotionally abusive in some ways. And I put up with that because I was so worried that I was never going to find the right person or anyone who was going to love me. And so I was willing to put up with a lot. And I think if I could go back in time, I would just say, hey, you're worth it. And you're going to come through this. You have what it takes, right? That simple phrase, you have what it takes.
Yes.
Just hang in there and heal and do the hard work of healing, and she'll be there. You just got to wait. And I think if I could go back in time and correct that, I think that would be the one thing that I would do, because I think that was so important to not get so caught up in the future and worrying about the future, but really worrying about the present and staying in the present and saying, I'm going to heal and do what I can to heal today. And I'll worry about tomorrow when tomorrow comes.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah. And you're very honest about that in the book. You know, several times you kind of have that comment, like, is anybody ever going to love me? And how you put up with, you know, mistreatment and abusive partners. And then, but ultimately, you know, you come to this place and love to hear now that, you know, that you just got married, that you're happy, that you have someone that loves you as is, right? That you know, you said, like, you know, your appearance has come a long way, that your scars have come a long way, but you still wear the scars, but you wear them now. It means something different to you. The meaning of the scars has changed. So maybe just a comment about that. When you talked about the shift in the meaning of the scars for you, what do they mean for you today? You hit on this a minute ago, I think, but I want you to, maybe just say it kind of explicitly here.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the scars for me today, when I look in the mirror and I wake up in the morning, you know, I see them as symbols of survival. I see them not only as symbols of survival, but I see them as reminders of the journey that I've traveled. And in some ways, I almost feel, you know, I'll look in the mirror and I'll be grateful. I remember the good things that have come out of this, right? I can see myself in a whole new light. And, you know, again, not being happy that this happened, of course, you know, I'm not going to say, if I was given the opportunity to go back in time and have the face that I was born with, right? Of course I would do that, right? I'm not saying that I choose this, but, you know, I'm grateful for the face I have, and I'm grateful that it can serve as a reminder of all that I've gone through, and all that's left, right? I have so much more to live, and I'm so excited for the future. And so for me, you know, they remind me of all that I've endured, and the joy and the pain and the sorrow and all those things wrapped in one. And for me, it just emboldens me. I think the difference is when I leave the bathroom every morning and I look in the mirror and I walk out of that bathroom, I'm now empowered to go out and conquer whatever it is
for
the rest of the day. Instead of it being a crippling emotion, it's a conquering, empowering emotion. And it just spurs me on for the rest of the day.
Oh, that's fantastic. I know you do mention in the book that several times, especially early on, about your concern that you'll never grow facial hair, because I'm guessing you wanted to be able to grow facial hair so you could cover everything up is kind of the meaning I took from that. And there's even kind of a kind of bittersweet, it's kind of funny but also kind of sad moment where you're seeing a plastic surgeon who's done a procedure to himself to stop his hair growth. So he's it's kind of like it's in your face, right? He's done this treatment to himself so that he can kind of keep this perennial 5 o'clock shadow. And you're just concerned about, am I ever going to grow hair again? And it's kind of a comical interchange really with this particular doctor that, is, I think some much needed comic relief at an important time for you. But anyway, at least the way you tell it in the story, I'm not sure it was so funny to you at the time, but anyway, I love that. So that's great. Samuel, I really appreciate this conversation. I wish we could sit here and talk all night. It's just fantastic. I love hearing your story. I love what you're doing with what you've been through. I love the themes that you've come with, that you're sharing your story as a speaker, now as an author, as an advocate and an activist for other burn victims through your involvement in the Phoenix Society. Did I say that right? The Phoenix Society.
Yeah, the Phoenix Society for Burn Survivors.
For Burn Survivors. Yeah. So I love that you're doing these things. I'm going to put a link in our show notes, of course, to your book, because I want my listeners to buy your book and read your story and hear your insights. I also will put a link to the Phoenix Society in case anybody out there hears this and wants to explore that or just learn more about it. I want to put that link there. And then I also like to put a way for our people to contact you. My audience are groups of people who like to share their stories. There may be something you said that really resonated with them, because for so many trauma survivors, as you know, one of the big pieces is we feel alone, we feel isolated, we feel shut in, like nobody else gets it. Nobody else has been through what I've been through. And it's kind of that moment of connection. And so many people are going to connect to you through this type of interviews that you do, through your speaking, through reading your story. So many people will connect to you. And then that may be the first time that somebody hears somebody say something that goes, oh my God, there's someone else out there who gets it. Right. So I get that a lot on my show. People will reach out to me and say, I've not ever talked about these things to anybody, but you get it, or you said something that really struck me, or the fact that, this show is here. In our Facebook group, sometimes somebody will say something and somebody else will respond. So this is a crowd that may desire to reach out to you, because what you have shared has been so powerful and will validate so many people's stories. That maybe just coming to the early stages of their own healing journey, no matter how many years it's been since the trauma. So what's the best way for people to get a hold of you, just to share a story or to ask a question?
Yeah, absolutely. I would love to hear from any of your audience members who want to share their story. It's always warms my heart to hear from other people who've read my book or heard from me and they want to reach out, and I'm always amazed by the stories and the resilience of so many people out there and the resilience of the human spirit. It's really remarkable to me. The best way to reach out to me, if you can go to my website, www.samuelmoore-sobel.com, and there's a contact page there that you can send me. It'll go straight to my email and I'll absolutely respond and converse with anybody who reached out to me there. They could also find me on social media at @smoore_sobel on Twitter and Instagram.
Okay, perfect. So I'll put those links in the show notes so people can get a hold of you and your website, your book, and the Phoenix Society for Burn Survivors. I think those are all such important things for people to have access to. So, Samuel, thank you so much for coming on the show, for sharing your story with me. I love this because I get to talk to you one-on-one, but sharing your story with our listeners, it's just such a powerful story, powerful insights, and powerful validation for so many people who are going to come to this, who knows when, and find your story, and that may be the first one they hear that says, wow, that really strikes a chord with me. So thank you so much for sharing and being willing to do what you do I loved reading your book, so thank you. And I look forward to hopefully keeping in touch and hearing from you again sometime. So thanks so much, and we appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much for having me on the show. It's been a pleasure talking with you, and I really wish you the best.
Thanks a lot. So there you have it, the interview with Samuel Moore Sobel, author of Can You See My Scars? As you can tell, just a delightful individual with an amazing story to tell. And I hope that you resonated with it, and particularly with his how he processed it, the rawness of the emotion, the honesty with which he shares the pain that he went through, but also the message of hope, of healing, and of forgiveness. So if you'd like to learn more about Samuel, you can reach him on his website, www.samuel-sobel.com. You can follow him on Twitter or Instagram at @smoore_sobel. And you can order his book on his website as well. And of course, I'll put all those links in the show notes for you so you can access them readily. And I want to send a very special thank you to Samuel for sharing his story and for showing each of us what it means to live unbroken.